Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast that discusses nonprofits, social justice, and activism. Right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan Clow, your host here on The Sector. And this is episode 5, which means we've made it 5 weeks. Congratulations, listeners. It's been a thrill for me too. Well, we have a great show today. We're going to be discussing last week's big question, as well as some recent news stories relevant to the nonprofit and social justice worlds. We're also going to take an extended look at how well the nonprofit sector has been doing. And we're going to take a closer look at an article written by Bill Gates on the myths about poverty. Remember, if you would like to send your thoughts to the sector or participate in our big question, you can visit us at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com or email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. And of course, we're on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast, and on Twitter at sectorpodcast. So you can tweet us and follow us as well. Just a reminder that on last Tuesday, the 22nd, my old show, A Radio Free Thinker, celebrated its 250th episode. So congrats to everyone who worked on that show. I'm actually going to be joining Don on next week's episode to discuss nonprofits in a special two-part series. The first part will air on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll focus on the who, what, where, when, and hows of nonprofits. That will be on the 29th at 3 o'clock Tuesday here on CITR. The second part will air here on The Sector on the 3rd at our usual time, Fridays at 8 a.m. And in part 2, we'll get into causes and missions. What are the major focuses of nonprofits in Canada and the world? Where is the most pressing issue that needs help? And how are nonprofits going about achieving that need and that help? It should all be very exciting, and I hope you'll tune into both shows. Well, let's just take a quick break here on The Sector. We'll be back and get into the news right after this.
I imagined what it would be like to be a wizard, and then I pretended and acted in that way on the day.
Studies show that 9 out of 10 wizards prefer CITR 101.9 FM.
If we were to draw a graph of my process, of my method, something like this, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian, action. Wizard, you shall not pass! Cut! Sir Ian, Sir Ian, Sir Ian.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
And we're back on The Sector. So some interesting items in the news, items related to nonprofits and social justice. One of the things that we've talked about a little bit in the past has been the issue of funding. Typically, there are three sources of funds: the public, individuals who donate, corporations, which could be grants or donations, and government. Government funding can also include a lot of additional resources that are less tangible. By putting a stamp of approval on a project, it can generate more interest from a professional who might want to work on something. It can also spur on donations and support from corporations and institutions. This is especially true of science funding. There was an article in the New York Times, "Billionaires with Big Ideas Are Privatizing American Science." We'll have a link to this on our show notes. The article, written by William J. Broad, discusses the big shift in funding for nonprofits in the science department. The article discusses the changes in recent years in which funding from government is slowly drying up, replaced by donations from the private sector. This, of course, is quite the radical shift. We traditionally think of the big-time science projects in America being funded almost exclusively by government. Space exploration, health and health sciences, technologies, etc. Yet with the recent gutting of science funding in America, these mega projects are going to disappear, right? Well, not necessarily. Look at the privately funded spaceflight programs out there. I mean, yes, at one point, those were a pipe dream. But the way things are going, it's starting to look like it may one day be a reality. Traditionally, the idea of spaceflight, especially by humans, was a domain that only government could accomplish. The amount of money, research, and other practicalities was something only government dollars could buy. However, things change. After NASA had its budget slashed, and after repeated cuts to aerospace technologies, basically resulting in the US dropping out of the business of putting people in space, the future looks a lot different. To the point that privately funded spaceflight may not be so far-fetched. And progress in space exploration has continued. I mean, new telescopes are being built, astrophysics R&D is continuing, but this progress is not being funded by the government, as the article explains. Budget cuts have left the nation's research complex reeling, closing labs, scientists being laid off, projects being put on the shelf. However, philanthropy for science is hot right now. In Silicon Valley and Wall Street, many of the richest Americans seek to become patrons of social progress through scientific research. To quote the article, "For better or worse," says Stephen A. Edwards, a policy analyst for the American Association for the Advancement of Science, "the practice of science in the 21st century is becoming shaped less by national priorities or by peer review groups and more by the peculiar preferences of individuals with huge amounts of money." And again, as the article points out, this isn't just funding the latest high-speed internet cables or some fancy electric car. We're talking about taking on deadly diseases, coming up with new and innovative treatment methods, or funding expeditions to find dinosaur bones. And as I mentioned before, the really big projects, like space exploration, telescopes, undersea crafts, and ships, major projects, all of these things are getting big dollars, major funding. It's no longer the realm of the government. One of the draws for this kind of investment is the desire for quick results. Private donors can take risks funding projects that the government would be too weary of. Private donors can risk failures that the government would be held accountable for. I mean, they're spending taxpayer money. Of course, we all know that science isn't done the way it's portrayed on TV and in the movies. While private funders like big projects, there's a lot of worry that they will ignore the tedious, nitty-gritty science research, which is where all the discoveries happen. To quote the article again, Nature, a family of leading science journals, has published a number of wary editorials, one warning that while we applaud and fully support the injection of more private money into science, the financing could also skew research towards fields more trendy than central. There's also the question of who owns all this amazing research. Publicly funded science is owned by, well, the public. It's a shared ownership that everyone can feel proud of and indeed responsible for. When the research is being funded by a private billionaire in their own personal lab with their own personal resources, is that really to the benefit of all? The notion of publicly funded science translates to publicly owned science can also be applied to other fields. We can look around and see the great work of nonprofits and charities that are fighting against poverty and homelessness. Yet they exist because there is some kind of lacking social safety net from government. If that net was there, would that be a greater source of public pride and engagement? Likewise, when there is a big scientific breakthrough which cures a deadly disease, do we want it brought to us, care of the guy who owns Tim Hortons and the Vancouver Canucks? That was just an example. I don't think Tim Hortons and the Canucks are involved in that kind of funding, but moving on with the rest of the article. Another quote. Historically, disease research has been particularly prone to unequal attention along racial and economic lines. A look at major initiatives suggests that philanthropic war on disease risks widening that gap, as a number of campaigns driven by personal adversity targets illnesses that predominantly affect white people, like cystic fibrosis, melanoma, and ovarian cancer. But it's not all bad, though. Many of these super-rich funders recognize the importance of nuts-and-bolts science research and are investing billions in that direction. Many of the donors are individuals who have pledged most of their fortunes to charities, and that net worth is $250 billion. So it seems like there's a trade-off. Well, on one hand, you have government-funded science, which is slow but meticulous, kept in trust for the benefit of the people. And then you have the sort of anti-bureaucratic world of private funding, with its deep pockets and a willingness to engage on huge projects. Now, here in Canada, we saw this play out in terms of the Experimental Lakes Program, which was a decades-long research initiative that operated out of a unique facility in Manitoba and Ontario. This program was a world-renowned environmental science facility, and when the Harper government decided to stop funding it in exchange for buying fighter jets and the like, a major project that could help us understand the future of climate change and our effect on our ecosystem was to be shut down during this so-called period of cutbacks. Now, fortunately, the project was saved by the province of Ontario and a nonprofit in Manitoba, saved at basically the 11th hour. Now, of course, this whole story is mirrored by the state of nonprofits and funding throughout the sector. More and more, government support is draining away, and nonprofits and charities are relying on private support. Now, perhaps a greater issue here is that the longer this goes on, the less likely government will go back to being generous and supporting public research or any other charitable cause. They'll be expected to always rely on the private sector. And again, private billionaires may be willing to spend lots of money on space exploration, but will a slightly less trendy but no less important project be left waiting because no one wants to fund the small little project that's very important but won't get into the headlines of major newspapers? Well, what do you all think, listeners? Let us know here on The Sector. In other nonprofit-related news, the Huffington Post recently featured an article about salaries for fundraisers, suggesting that these fundraisers make too much money. The title of the piece is "Salaries Up for Top Fundraisers: Defies What Nonprofits Were Created For, Expert," by Brett Zonker, and we'll have a link to this on our show notes so you can check out the article for yourselves. Now, according to Zonker, there's a new study of 280 nonprofits released by the Washington-based Chronicle of Philanthropy, a newspaper that covers the nonprofit world. Anyway, it suggests that nearly 30 top fundraisers are making more than $500,000 in the U.S. in salaries and benefits. This information is from 2011, and during that year, at least two fundraisers made more than $1 million. One of these fundraisers worked with Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, and the other works at New York's Columbia University. The article goes on to say that over two dozen fundraisers were making between $500,000 and $1 million. And the big organizations that are paying this kind of salary? Well, it's universities and hospital foundations. To quote from the article, "You have a very small elite group of fundraisers that are in extremely high demand, that are becoming millionaires while raising funds for a public charity that is supported by taxpayers, said Ken Berger, president of the nonprofit watchdog group Charity Navigator. So what's with these excessive paydays? As a potential donor, does this information make you less likely to donate to a cause if you know that a fundraiser is making a large amount of money? Well, let's take a look at some of the factors here before we make our conclusion. One of the fundraisers I mentioned, who is making $1.2 million in 2011, she works at the Cancer Center in New York. She is co-leading a $3.5 billion campaign. So if we crunch the numbers, what she's making, $1.2 million, and what she's raising, $3.5 billion, she's being paid less than 1% of the amount she's helping to raise. Now, $1.2 million is still a lot of money. But ask yourself, if this was the private sector, and you told Coca-Cola or Nike or Apple that for $1.2 million you could bring in $3.5 billion, billion with a B, what kind of industry standard salary would profit maximization like that be worth? I'm guessing it's more than $1.2 million. I think this brilliantly connects with our last news stories. Government funding is drying up, meaning that nonprofits are turning more and more to the private sector. And as we discussed, there's a lot of money out there. So if you have the skills to bring in those kind of donations, you are a premium talent. Now, granted, it's not like she's doing all the work here. But again, we should keep in mind that a fundraiser is typically paid a lot if they can fundraise a lot. This is a results-driven industry. We've learned that actually from our interviews here on the show. One of the interesting aspects of this is that the organizations that pay that kind of money typically are hospitals, universities, or medical centers and the like. Very rarely do arts organizations or environmental charities have staff with salaries that large. Why? Well, very rarely do arts organizations or environmental charities fundraise that much money. Another aspect of this, and this is what I feel to be a knee-jerk reaction, where we feel uncomfortable with someone doing very well financially for doing a good service to society. Fundraising is not easy. Most people can't do it. In fact, most people have a panic attack if they're asked to pick up the phone and call somebody for money. It takes a lot of training and relationship skills to know how to work with people and how to ask for money and figure out a way to be successful at it. I mean, there's a reason that organizations that have volunteer fundraisers aren't raising the kind of money that professionals are bringing in. That's why a volunteer organization is not going to bring in the same amount of money as a hospital foundation or a university. And getting back to what I was saying earlier about doing well while helping, that the idea that someone could make a lot of money fundraising might rub us the wrong way. I mean, if someone is making $1 million while working for a charity, how needy could that charity be? Well, when the charity is putting over $3 billion to work for its mission, that $1 million is money well spent if securing the rest of that pie. But why don't we have the same moral umbrage at people in the private sector making millions, and sometimes a whole lot more than millions, selling fast food, cell phones, or crappy movies? Well, food for thought at the very least. Let's take a quick break here on The Sector. We'll be back with more after this.
For the very best in bluegrass music, plus classic country, Cajun, rockabilly, western swing, and whatever jumps off the shelves at us. Tune in every Tuesday morning at 6:30 for Pacific Pickin' with your host, Arthur Berman.
And I'm Andrea.
The lovely Andrea, who will also provide you with our concert calendar and every bit of news and information you can possibly need. And as if that wasn't enough, there's a warm-up show at 6 featuring a little bit of a wider variety of roots and branches of bluegrass music. So tune in each morning, 6 for the warm-up show, 6:30 for the main show, Pacific Pickin' on
CITR
101.9 in Vancouver.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power Science World for over 75 years. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
And we're back here on The Sector on CITR 101.9 FM with me, Ethan Clow. So let's take a look at last week's big question. How successful do you think the nonprofit sector is in making change happen? Now, it's an interesting debate. What sort of changes has the nonprofit sector managed in the last few decades? Where has the sector failed to make an impact? What regions, what specific causes have been successful and what have failed? Now, the broadness of the sector prevents us from making any sweeping conclusions. But on a whole, what do you think? When you look at the major objectives of nonprofits here in Canada, to end poverty, to end hunger, homelessness, to protect the environment, or to provide health services, do you see an improvement in any of these areas? Poverty is a particularly difficult thing to track, and this is because there isn't even an agreed-upon definition. One way of looking at it is from the point of view of absolute poverty, a condition characterized by severe deprivation of basic human needs, including food, safe drinking water, sanitation, health, shelter, education, and information. Based on that, one would then define the basic needs that a person needs to survive, essentially the absolute minimum resources needed for long-term physical well-being, usually in terms of consumption goods. The poverty line is then defined as the amount of income required to satisfy those needs. This is the basic needs approach and was introduced by the International Labour Organization's World Employment Conference in 1976. Other methods include a relative poverty metric, such as the low income cutoff, otherwise known as the LICO. This measure is often quoted as the best measure, although Stats Canada doesn't officially state this as a poverty measure, although this is what they use to measure poverty, and there's some politics behind that decision. Now, additionally, the CIA also uses this measurement, uses this metric as its measurement of poverty. So, there are a number of official organizations that are using this one, and generally speaking, in my research, it seems to be the most common used one. The measure is intended to represent the income threshold below which a family will likely devote a larger share of its income on the necessities of food, shelter, and clothing, more so than the average family. As of 2008, 9.4% of Canadians are in a family whose income is below the after-tax low-income cutoff. Now, if you look at what some of these metrics show, poverty levels in Canada have hovered around the 10% mark, meaning 10% of Canada's population lives in poverty. This number dips and rises over the decades. For instance, it was 15.2% in 1996 and 9.1% in 2007. Now, the good news, if you can call this good news, is that poverty rates had been trending downwards since the mid-1990s. The bad news is that this is still subject to the rise and fall of the economy. And keep in mind, trending downwards doesn't necessarily mean a dramatic decrease. As I said, 15.2% in 1996, 9.1% in 2007, that's a drop of more than 5%, but we're still talking about spread over the course of several years. So it goes down 3%, goes back up 1%, goes down 0.5%, goes back up 1%. So we're not exactly talking about a rapid decline here. You might ask yourself, hasn't there been a concerted effort to lower poverty in Canada for more than just two decades? Well, absolutely. The real movement to end poverty in Canada began in the late 60s, and in 1968, the Economic Council of Canada released a study saying that 27% of the Canadian population lived in poverty. 27% of the population lived in poverty. So, if you take all these numbers at face value, it's taken Canada about four decades and change to bring the poverty level from 27% to 9%. Now, I'm not even going to say that this is evidence that poverty is being fixed in Canada. What do you all think about this? There are more factors here to poverty than simply being able to buy enough food to make it through the day or have shelter or clothing. We all know this. It's controversial to say that poverty has more nuance to it. There are economic factors, there are political factors, there are ethnic and racial limits to poverty. The most hard hit by poverty are Aboriginal peoples here in Canada. And the difficulty is, of course, is that the census, in order for it to find you, you need an address, you need to be tracked down. If you're homeless or you're living in poverty, it may be hard for Stats Canada or anyone else to get a good record on you and understand exactly where you are or what your financial levels are. So there's a significant hurdle to tracking poverty like this. It's not something that you can just look up on Wikipedia. There are political boundaries to poverty that we are only beginning to understand. And I think this is a topic that we're going to come back to later in the show, but let's just, for the sake of argument, say, let's move on. Now, poverty, in some sense, is easier to track than things like environmental protection. There's not a lot of records on environmental protection that we can convert into numbers and say, Canada has gotten better at environmental protection. If anything, recent news stories may make us think that Canada has gotten a lot worse at environmental protection. And again, that's also difficult to track. I mean, that could just be confirmation bias. But when you look at things like the pipeline here in BC, the Experimental Lakes Program, the failure of Canada to meet the Kyoto Protocols, and again, it seems to be this sort of political move to sort of ignore the issue of climate change. One could wonder if our environmental protection sector is, well, falling behind significantly. But again, moving on. Certainly more people are aware of these issues now. But does awareness translate into change or making things better? This touches base with a lot of previous topics that we've mentioned, things like slacktivism, or sort of the new kind of armchair activism that you do from Facebook, where you like posts and share posts and sign petitions. Certainly we're more aware of the need for environmental protection. We're more aware of the need for poverty relief. We're more aware of the need to help people who are in trouble. But is that necessarily translating to more action being taken? I don't know, actually. I'm a little, maybe a little bit pessimistic about that, but it seems like awareness is not necessarily translating into change. And sort of an aside, in fundraising, when you have a fundraising campaign and at the end of the campaign you say, well, we were able to raise awareness, that usually translates into we failed to raise money. So it's an interesting question about awareness and change. But we'll come back to that in more details on the sector. Let's continue on with this idea here, though. If we make the assumption that the nonprofit world hasn't been able to change things the way we hoped, why would that be? Now, I mean, perhaps the most realistic answer is that these problems, poverty, homelessness, environmental protection, etc., etc., are huge systemic problems. And they require huge solutions that are simply out of reach for the average nonprofit. You could make the analogy that the nonprofit sector is running around putting band-aids on things, but no one has treated the real problem. And there's all kinds of reasons why this could happen like this. Some would say that nonprofits are too underfunded to make lasting change. Or that these problems are simply too large for any single nonprofit or any combination of nonprofits to adequately change. Others would say that government is the only institution that has the reach and resources to change societies. And still others would say that our problems are based on outdated ideologies and incompatible worldviews. What would you say the major problem is? Now, I mean, again, not to disparage any nonprofits out there, because they are doing amazing work. We all know and see that. So then why hasn't change happened? We can look at, as an example, say InSight, Vancouver Safe Injection Site. It's been a phenomenal success. Why hasn't more safe injection sites and harm reduction as a philosophy caught on like wildfire in Canada? Surely, success should be an example of why we should continue something. Well, I mean, we all know the answer. Politics and other sort of intrigue factors have limited the spread of harm reduction policies in Canada. Is it possible that there are other political motivations that are limiting the success of nonprofits, that are limiting their ability to do mission and achieve causes and objectives that would change society? What about the private sector? The private sector has more resources, more funding, more everything, really, than the nonprofit sector, and yet only a small handful have sort of taken on a socially entrepreneurial role in society of reaching out and trying to make change happen. Should we be more, perhaps we should be less, for instance, less critical of the nonprofit sector and more critical of the for-profit sector? Maybe we should be saying, you know, it's not enough that big companies like TELUS or Tim Hortons or others should be more active and making an effort to do really good things with the wealth and the power that they've gotten from providing services to Canadians. And maybe that's on us as a population to make it clear that we want our private sector to be more invested in our community. Again, this is all food for thought. And like I said before at the top of the segment, there's simply no way that we can answer this question in one short little segment here on the sector. But keep in mind, we'll come back to this in the future. And I really want to get your feedback on this. If you want to participate in the big question of the week here with us at the sector, you can email us your thoughts at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can visit us online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And of course, we're on Facebook and Twitter, so you can tweet us at sectorpodcast, or you can tweet me, Ethan Clow, at Ethan Clow on Twitter. I know, very creative. And of course, on Facebook, find us Sector Podcast. So let's take a quick break here on the show. We'll be back with more after this.
Beautiful country. You know, I rode out here about 50 years ago on a little dun horse and started a film career. Picture called The Big Trail. Well, I made quite a few since then. Some good, some bad. Matter of fact, in those days,
CITR!
Matter of fact, they come in pretty handy anytime. It's kind of nice to know you have something set aside. So if you ever figure on that, remember that
CITR
can be mighty helpful.
Yeehaw!
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk. Approach any SafeWalk team or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Because you're mine, I walk the line.
And we're back on the sector here on CITR. So earlier in the year, Bill and Melinda Gates put out an annual letter discussing philanthropy and making the world a better place. We'll have this in our show notes as always, so check out our webpage for that. To quote from the article, "By almost any measure, the world is better than it has ever been. People are living longer, healthier lives. Many nations that were aid recipients are now self-sufficient. You might think that such striking progress would be widely celebrated. But in fact, Melinda and I are struck by how many people think the world is getting worse. The belief that the world can't solve extreme poverty and disease isn't just mistaken, it is harmful. That is why in this year's letter, we take apart some of the myths that slow down the work. The next time you hear these myths, we hope that you'll do the same." So in the article, Gates outlines what he calls three myths that are blocking progress for poor companies. The first one, myth one, poor countries are doomed to stay poor. The second myth, foreign aid is a big waste. And myth three, saving lives leads to overpopulation. Now they also included three little videos, and I'm going to play the audio for you now. And after you listen to them, we'll come back and discuss them in greater detail.
In 1960, Americans, people in Western Europe, lived in fairly rich countries. They called them developed, that had very good health. So the number of children who died under five was very, very low. So this is us out here. Most people lived in developing countries where they... childhood health was so bad that over 25% of the kids in those countries died before they reached the age of five. And we had the Soviet countries, you know, first world here, second world here, and third world here. Now, we've done a lot of invention, a lot of aid to try and help improve this picture. So what does it look like 50 years later? Well, health is dramatically improved. Even in the low-income countries, half as many kids are dying at young age. And most countries have moved into a category I call middle income. We can't think of these as one block of developing countries because now China, Mexico, Brazil, so many are up here. And, of course, the developed countries are doing even better. But huge progress on health and incomes, and aid generosity has been a big part of it. So it's a myth that we haven't made progress and that aid hasn't helped.
So there are a lot of myths associated with health, with world health. Well, as a science educator who fights myths, I've spent some time looking at the data. It's remarkable. We can see how, we can see why kids are dying, and we can see how to prevent it. Well, people perceive that the U.S. spends a lot on foreign aid, that if the U.S. budget were a dollar, a quarter of it is spent on foreign aid. But that's not true. That's not. It's less than a penny. It's 0.8% of the federal budget. You can't even cut a coin small enough to represent how much money is spent on foreign aid. It's not that much. Now, this idea that wars or natural disasters, tsunamis, earthquakes, kill most of the people, that's wrong. It pales. It's dwarfed by the number of people killed by preventable diseases. This sector represents the number of kids 5 years old and younger that die every year from injuries. This represents the number of kids 5 years old and younger that die every year from non-communicable diseases, cancer, things you inherit. But all of this, most of the circle, is kids dying 5 years old or younger, dying of communicable, preventable diseases. This is where we can change the world. People think that we've been sending money to Africa for decades and nothing's improved. Things are as bad as they ever were. Well, that's a myth. When you can show statistically that child mortality's gone down over the last couple decades by a factor of two, been cut in half, those are the data. We have a real opportunity to leave the world better than we found it, to dispel these myths and move on to improve the quality of life of people everywhere. So let's prevent the diseases. Let's address a preventable disaster.
A common misunderstanding is that if we save all the poor children, the world will become overpopulated. This may sound logical, but it's wrong. It's the other way around. Saving the poor children's lives is required to end population growth. Now, look at the UN numbers. Poor parents, on average, have 5 children, and one dies. Look, 2 parents are replaced by 4 surviving children in the next generation. This means population is growing very fast among the poorest. This is the average family in the worst of places, like Congo and Afghanistan. Today, where child mortality is highest, that's where population is growing faster than anywhere else. How many people live like this? There are 7 billion people in the world. 1 block, 1 billion. The poorest 2 billion, they live like this. The other 5 billion, they have this average family. 2 parents having 2 children, and there are few child deaths. This is the majority of the world population, not only Europe and the US. It's throughout religions and cultures. China, Iran, Mexico, large cities in Africa. Today, in most population, children just replace parents, and the size of generations are no longer increasing. This means the population will stop growing. How did so many people end up with small families? Well, their children stopped dying, as they left extreme poverty and girls got education. Parents no longer had to compensate for child death by having many babies. And a large family stopped being an economic necessity or a social status symbol. And with modern contraceptives, parents across the world, the majority, decided to have a small family. So, by saving the lives of poor children and helping the last 2 billion out of poverty, these parents will also decide to have fewer children. And fewer. Eventually, reaching the two-child family. That showed the UN family size forecast up to the end of the century. Then the world population is expected to stop growing. Before it stops, another 4 billion people will be added to the world population. 4 billion more, that's a lot of people. But the longer poor children keeps dying and this change is delayed, the more billions will be added. So, ending population growth starts by saving the poorest children.
And we're back here on The Sector. So just so everyone knows, the first video featured Bill Gates. The second was Bill Nye, the science guy. And the third was Hans Rosling. And again, I will have the show notes for today's episode up very soon, and you'll be able to find the links to these videos as well as the initial article by Bill Gates. Since we are running out of time and we don't exactly have the opportunity to dive into this as much as I'd like to, why don't we make this the next big question of the week? Have a look at the article. Take a look at the videos, think about it, and consider the questions that Bill Gates raises. In fact, the assertions that these are myths, poor countries are doomed to stay poor, foreign aid is a big waste, and saving lives leads to overpopulation. Do you agree that those are myths? Do you think that Bill Gates is right in what he says about these sort of things, that right now the world is better off than it ever was? This is actually kind of reminiscent of conversations that we've had on Radio Free Thinker, discussing, for example, the works of Steven Pinker and his book about violence declining. It's a controversial statement because we hear all the time about bad things happening, but is it true? Is in fact things really, really good right now, and we just don't really understand that? So take a look at the article, take a look at the questions. And the big question is Bill Gates right? Do you agree with him? Do you think that we're better off now than we've ever been? And in fact, these myths are indeed myths and that they are harmful to the development of the rest of the world. So that is the big question of the week. Remember, you can find our show notes online at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. And download the podcast while you're at it. Once again, we don't have a pitch of the week for you, but stay tuned for next week's show. As I mentioned, we'll have on my friend Don McLennigan from Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be discussing nonprofits and charitable causes. So we'll be sure to get Don's pitch of the week for sure. We can also get Don's take on the question of the week. And if you want to add your two cents, please be sure to send us an email or tweet about our big question of the week. Now, the two-part nonprofit discussion can be heard on Radio Free Thinker starting on Tuesday, the 29th at 3 p.m. right here on CITR. Or you can download the podcast over at radiofreethinker.com. And the second part will be right here on The Sector next Friday at our usual time, 8 a.m. And again, via podcast if you don't want to get up that early. Well, we've reached the end of yet another show, so my thanks to everyone for joining me. I'll see you all next week, right here on The Sector.
Do the beat. Yo, what's up, man?